Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone, and I hope you're having a nice day. And it's snowing up here in Upper Westchester, but not too hard. But the sun's going to shine by the time I get done because we have one of the most fantastic authors here. We're going to talk about a great book. But before I start, I have to thank the people at Northwell Health Urgent Care for treating me like I was a rock star. As a matter of fact, they treated me better than that on Tuesday when I came there when I was a little out of sorts. And I want to thank especially Mohammed for calling me back yesterday to make sure that I'm okay. Sandra, the PA, and William, he's a really cute girl, seriously. He takes your vitals and everything. So I want to thank them a million times for caring enough about me and telling me that they're there for me all the time. And on that note, I would like to introduce the author of Offstage Left. And as it says in my promo, acting can be dangerous to your health. Aspiring actress Isabel Spice lands her first regional theater job, playing a supporting role and understudying the lead in Susico, The Life and Times of John Philip Sousa, one of my favorite composers. A series of minor backstage accidents culminates in the suspicious death of the leading lady on opening night, and Isabel wants to ask to take over. And that's all I'm going to say about that. And I'm going to introduce Joanne Sidney Lesner. And good morning. How are you?
I'm very well, Fran. How are you?
Okay. Could give us listeners, not too much because we don't want to give anything away, a brief summary of what this book is about so they'll all go out and buy it for Hanukkah and Christmas for everybody?
Well, Offstage Left is actually the fourth book in my Isabel Spice mystery series, but I want to say right off the bat, they do not have to be read in order. I've done that on purpose. Isabel is an aspiring actress who moves to New York to pursue her career, and she winds up temping, as many of us did when we moved to New York to start our acting careers. And by the time we get to book four, she's finally gotten a legitimate acting job at a regional theater in Albany, and she is hired for a musical called Susical, The Life and Times of John Philip Sousa, and she has a small part, and she's understudying the leading lady, and she's there with her boyfriend who's conducting the show and one of her best friends who is actually also understudying John Philip Sousa. And the leading lady meets with an unfortunate end in full view of the audience on opening night. Isabel is her understudy, and Isabel has been a very conscientious understudy, so she jumps right in knowing the part cold, which of course raises the suspicions of her fellow actors. So she finds herself immediately in the position of having to find out who killed the leading lady so she doesn't get accused of murder herself.
Wow. But that's interesting. Yeah, I know. And then she takes, she's a combination of Jessica Fletcher, Hattie Winthrop, and Agatha Christie a little bit.
Oh, I'll take it. I'll take it. I've also gotten Stephanie Plum, which I'll take also. Actually, who Isabel really is me when I was 23, minus the dead bodies. I moved to New York after college to pursue. Yeah, right. There were a few people I wanted to off along the way. I moved to New York after I graduated college to pursue my performing career. And I wound up temping and had the idea for this series all those many years ago. It took me a long time to write it. So there's a lot of myself in Isabel, which has actually been quite a lot of fun to write. But I will take all those comparisons to other great sleuths. Absolutely.
Yeah, those are the people I read, besides Joachim Perrault, who I love completely.
Oh, the best. There's nobody better.
Yeah, I love murder mysteries. They're great. So, it says also, I read in your bio, that you were on stage. You did some acting also?
Yeah, I've had a very nice career. I made my Broadway debut when I was 28 in Cyrano, the musical, which was very exciting.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it was great. I might let Isabel get to Broadway sooner than I did, or I might not. I've done a lot of regional theater and actually regional opera as well. And I just did a production of Mamma Mia this past summer at Weston Playhouse in Vermont. It was part of their 80th season. And that was probably the most fun I have ever had on stage.
Oh, I love Mamma Mia. That's a great play. I love that.
It was so much fun. It was crazy fun.
Yeah, You're bringing back memories. My sister, I lost my sister 6 years ago, but she used to do Broadway shows and stuff like that. She was the one in the family that could sing, and then there was me, who could play the piano and the violin, but I couldn't sing, and I was the music major. But
really,
what can I say?
I did
major in music in college, but unfortunately they had to do voice, and I was so good that the professor, after I did my program, which was original program of no one would ever get up and do this because I was brave, said, "You did a very good job. Now I'm going to give you an extra B+ not to take the second class." And I took it.
I think that's so unfortunate that people say that to young singers, because really anybody can learn how to sing. I mean, unless you really have some kind of physical impairment that makes it impossible. But with the right training, people can make a lot of improvement. And I think if you love to sing, you should be encouraged to sing, even if other people aren't necessarily encouraged to listen.
I had the world's worst voice in America, and everybody got up and sang opera arias. And I got up and performed my own program that my sister helped me perform. And the starring song of it was Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. Seriously. I sang all the nursery rhymes. And I sang on perfect pitch, so it didn't matter. I didn't care. But tell us a little bit about Isabel and in your previous books, because I only read this one.
Yeah, well, so the very first scene of the very first book, which is called The Temporary Detective, is actually based on something that happened to me. I moved to New York after 4 years of college and tried to temp, and I went around from temp agency to temp agency, and nobody would take me on because I had no office experience. And I kept saying, of course I have no office experience. I've been in college for the last 4 years. But it was amazing. They wouldn't look past that. I typed 70 words a minute. I was like, I can juggle as many phones as you need. And I finally got to this one temp agency. I can't even remember the name of it. And the guy behind the desk, he was a very striking man. He was a broad-shouldered black man. He was very handsome and he was really very nice. And I basically was like, I'm not leaving until you agree to send me out. And I wore him down. And he said, I will send you out for a half day as a trial period. And I was like, okay. So I went out on this job, and it was fine. And then he started sending me out on lots of temp jobs. So that's actually what happens to Isabel on the first page of the first book. Unlike me, I never saw this lovely man ever again, although he basically made it possible for me to earn a living. I thanked him by making him a character in my books. And in fact, he does not appear in Offstage Left because he is her temp agent, so he's rooted in New York City. The other books all take place in New York City. But James, that's the character's name, James Cook, is Isabel's temp agent. And they wind up having a very interesting, very stormy love-hate relationship. And James is a recovering alcoholic who was kicked out of Columbia University for various reasons that come out in the second book. So she has this kind of stormy relationship with James, who in many ways is her Watson. And then she also has these two best friends that she meets waiting in line for her very first New York City audition. And they are actually based on, I just pillaged my own life for my books. It's really shameless. Isabel's two best friends are Delphi and Sunil, and they are based on two people that I met very early on. And actually the model for Sunil is probably somebody you've all heard of, the actor Asif Manvi from The Daily Show. Mm-hmm. He was the model for Sunil. Although I don't believe Asif sings, when I told him, I put in my book, he was somewhat taken aback. Mm-hmm. And the model for Delphi is a friend of mine who has been one of my best friends now for over 25 years. So Isabel moves to New York. She starts temping. And in the first three books, the murders happen in various office settings. So in the first book, in The Temporary Detective, James sends her out for a half day of phones and light typing and a dead body. A dead secretary shows up in the bathroom, you know, as often happens. And Isabel winds up solving the crime. In the second book, she temps at a public relations firm, and a client meets an unfortunate end there. And in the third one, is actually kind of interesting. She and Delphi, her best friend, are hired to perform in like murder mystery dinner theater. And of course, somebody really one of the guests actually gets killed. So those are sort of what happens with the first three books. But my whole reason for writing the series. I'm like you. I'm a huge mystery fan. I mean, that is my go-to. I need something to read. I'm going to grab a mystery novel. But also, what I found pursuing my performing career, and this was a while ago when I was really, you know, starting out and pounding the pavement like Isabel is. Most people have no idea what that is like day to day. For example, if you are not online waiting outside the studio to sign up for an audition, if you're not waiting in line by 6 a.m., you're probably not going to get a spot. And that's still true. So it's really exhausting, and it can be really demoralizing, and you have to go on so many auditions before you get a job. Mm. And a lot of it has to do with who you wind up meeting and who you wind up befriending and all of that kind of stuff. And there's so much luck involved. And it's really hard because you're getting up at 6 in the morning, you're standing outside in the freezing cold or the pouring rain waiting to put your name on a list to come back at 4 o'clock that afternoon and sing, by which time you are absolutely exhausted because you've been up since 5 in the morning. Oh, and P.S., all day you've been working at a temp job. So, you know, people don't realize what it actually takes to follow that dream. And it was very important to me to tell that story because I don't think it's been told. And the idea of doing a mystery series affords me a wonderful opportunity to let Isabel's acting career unfold, like, in parallel to her detective career. So it's a great way to tell that story without having it be a series about a girl breaking into show business. It becomes the backstory, but I hope and I think we really get attached to these supporting characters and their relationships. My favorite mystery series always, what keeps me going back to Reginald Hill and Colin Dexter and Elizabeth George is what happens in between the books, even to those supporting characters and those regular characters. That was the longest answer in the history of the world.
That's okay. Sometimes the supporting characters eventually make their own novel too, become a major character.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you never know, right?
Absolutely. If I spin anyone off, it'll probably be Isabel's genius younger brother, who also doesn't appear in this book. I feel like in Monty Python and the Holy Grail, sir, not appearing in this film, because it takes Isabel out of town to Albany. Some of the recurring characters are not here, but she in the first book and the third book, she has this boy genius younger brother who goes to Columbia when he's 16, and he winds up, of course, you know, providing critical clues that help her solve the mystery. He's actually based on my son, who was TAing at Columbia when he was a high school student in upper-level computer science classes, so which he does not get from me. Let's just be very straight about that. But anyway, he's a very popular character. James is also a popular character. So if I were ever going to spin anything off, I don't think it would be her fellow actors. I think it would be her brother or her temp agent.
Well, why did you decide to write about John Philip Sousa, who I love? And why did you miss the musical score?
Sousa is great. It's great stuff. Do you know any of his operettas? Yeah, have you ever heard any of his operettas?
Yes, because I majored in music and I had to memorize the operettas, literally.
Wow, I'm impressed because many people don't know them. He's really a national gem. So, but I have to make a full confession here. I wanted the musical in Off Stage Left to be bad, because here's another thing that happens to actors is you get so excited, you're hired for a brand new musical. You think this is going to be your ticket to Broadway. You're originating a role in, you know, the next Hamilton, and then you show up on the first day of rehearsal, and you're like, oh, my God, this is awful. So I was trying to think of, like, what's, like, the worst idea for a musical ever. So I went on Facebook, and I said, okay, guys, contest. And I said, who can come up with the worst idea for a musical? And, boy, I got some doozies, you know, Titus Andronicus, the musical. I mean, all kinds of stuff. But the one that made me laugh every time I went back was Sousical, The Life and Times of John Philip Sousa, where all the songs are lyricized Sousa marches, and I thought that was hilarious. And then I started reading about Sousa, and as wonderful a composer as he was, his life was completely uninteresting. There's no drama, there's no conflict, there's no tension. It's like a terrible idea for a musical. But I have never had more fun than when I was coming up with lyrics for these Sousa marches. That was so much fun. So I love Sousa. So I don't mean to be making fun of him at all as a person, but it's his life story is not great fodder for a musical. And the idea of actually trying to put words to those wonderful marches, I mean, and they are wonderful pieces of music. But it's, you know, if you look at Everybody Walks Around Singing, you know, be kind to your web-footed friends, for a duck could be somebody's mother. I mean, that's Sousa. That's the Stars
yep.
and Stripes. So, like, it's very easy to write doggerel to his marches. They were never meant to be sung. So the idea that somebody would create a musical with singing to Sousa marches, I thought, okay, this has got great comic potential. And I hope my readers will, you know, if you don't know the Stars and Stripes or the Washington Post, you know, if you a quick trip to YouTube, you can get that melody in your head and sing along to some of the lyrics in the show. And it's a little fun side activity.
As long as Fran doesn't sing along to the show.
No, you can. You get to sing along.
I try, yeah. As a matter of fact, what happens is if somebody writes about music or whatever, or there's a musical score. I did a review before Prince died, but his book, Prince the Man of Music, right before he died, and I sent the review to the publicist, and it was fantastic. But first I listened to the music again to make sure that when I wrote the review that the music reflected it, that I remembered what it sounded like, because he was fantastic. So what happens in this particular story, there's a subplot where they created a book about the play, and what happens when somebody decides to make changes in the book, and then it makes changes in the music. So how does that affect the players and then the actors and stuff to learn their part?
Well, actually, just to be specific about it, the book to a musical is actually the script. So it's not that they wrote a book about the musical. When I refer, because I do refer to the book of the musical, but that's the dialogue. So every musical has three components, book, music, and lyrics. So lyrics and music are obvious, and then the book is the script. So there's a character named Jethro Hamilton, and he is a Sousa enthusiast, and he has written the entire thing. Well, obviously not the music, because that's Sousa. So he's written the book, and he's the one who has taken the Sousa marches and written lyrics. But you find out fairly early on that there was another score, an original score, that had original music that wasn't Sousa, and original lyrics that weren't Jethro's, and the guy who writes the music and lyrics gets fired from the project, and then Jethro steps in and takes the Sousa marches and writes his own lyrics. And that is actually something that happens in real life. And in fact, I cited a few real life examples of where that happened. There was a musical on Broadway, Little Women, and after I think it was like one of the early workshops, the entire score got thrown out and rewritten by new people. So that actually can happen. And if it's happening, you know, in the middle of a rehearsal process, that's unlikely. Usually it happens between workshops or between productions. But it is something that happens.
Well, that's interesting. Now, see, there's a whole bunch of people in the Liberty Company. There's Sunil, there's Melissa Arden, and, of course, you. He's unique and Thomas.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us something about the cast. And Isabel is going out with you. I'm trying to figure out why, though.
So it's the Livingston Stage Company is the name of the theater that I have made up out of thin air in Albany, New York. So you've got Isabel. Her boyfriend is Hugh. Hugh is a composer himself and a conductor and music director. And he's essentially my husband with an English accent, because the only thing that's wrong with my husband is that he doesn't have an English accent. But he is in fact a composer and a conductor. So Hugh is sort of based on my husband, Josh. And he is just a lovely, supportive, very sweet, intellectual British gentleman. And they've been dating for a little while, even though, as I was talking earlier about James Cook, Isabel's temp agent, there's a bit of a romantic triangle happening there. And it remains to be seen which one of these two very different men, if either of them, Isabel winds up with. Sunil is the character I said is based on is based on my friend Asif. Sunil's an interesting character. I also borrowed from somebody else that I know. Sunil is of Indian descent, and he's also Jewish. I only found this out fairly recently. As a Jewish woman myself, I didn't even know this, that there is a community of Indian Jews, which I thought was fascinating. And the first thing I thought of was, oh, my God, they must eat so well. So Sunil, he's got this gorgeous tenor voice that he's inherited from his father, who was a cantor. And as a brown person, he gets typecast a lot, and there are a lot of roles that aren't available to him. And there's a little bit of a racist exchange between him and Jethro at one point in the book, because Sunil is understudying Sousa, and Jethro is the author, sort of like, yeah, but you're never going to go on because Sousa was white. And it's funny because I wrote this before Hamilton, I mean, which is, you know, an amazing example of how we can and should move past those physical stereotypes to let the best person for the role step forward. So Sunil carries with him a lot of professional frustration that he doesn't get the opportunities he feels his talent deserves. Arden is the leading lady, who is rather stuck up and full of herself, which of course usually means that she's deeply insecure. She is a former Miss New York who got knocked out of the Miss America pageant for the swimsuit competition, but that's her only claim to fame, and that's why she's playing the lead, because they think she's going to be a big draw at the box office. Mm. Thomas is the costume designer, and he is he's a great character. He's just flamboyant and gossipy and wonderful. And, you know, and I say this a few times in the book, and I'm actually about to send a copy of the book to the woman who designed costumes for Mamma Mia last summer, and she will get a big kick out of this. But it's true. The costume shop always knows what's going on. If you want to find out what's going on in a theater company, ask the costume department. It's like they've got a hotline into the gossip, into what's going on administration-wise in the theater. So Thomas becomes an important source of information for Isabel. Jethro Hamilton is the book writer and lyricist of Seussical. And it's funny because my phone is ringing. I actually gave him the last name Hamilton before the musical happened. It's very popular. The name is very much in the public awareness now. And the whole reason that this musical is getting produced is that his aunt is the artistic director and producer of the theater. So there's a little hint of nepotism going on there as well. Marissa is one of the actresses, and she's sort of a character actress. So she plays, characters who aren't necessarily, she's a young woman, but she, you know, winds up sort of playing kind of, she plays Sousa's mother, and she has some issues with Isabel, and she has some issues with Arden. And then there's another character named Talia, who's an opera singer, who is trying to get more theater credits on her resume. So she's not much of an actress, but she's got a beautiful voice. And in fact, I'm sure you know this, when John Philip Sousa's band toured, they brought a soprano along to sing opera arias with a band accompaniment, which is very unusual because, of course, an opera orchestra is, you know, a lot of strings and woodwinds. So here you've got someone singing, you know, A Forse Lui from La Traviata over trumpets and trombones, which I think is kind of an interesting thing. So anyway, so she is another character who is taking a part in Seussical. So that's sort of the main lineup.
Well, that's interesting. That is interesting. So she's chosen to play Emma for the play. She has to understudy it, and it's part Lee Jenny. Why does that make her a candidate? Well, she leaves herself wide open.
She does. And I have to say, the first time I ever understudied, I was, like Isabel, a little overeager. Well, first of all, I mean, it's a fine line. If you're understudying and you have to go on, you better have done your work, your homework, and you better have done your job, and you better be ready to jump in. Because a lot of times understudies don't get a lot of rehearsal, or sometimes they have to go on before they've had any rehearsal. This just happened on Broadway with the revival of Falsettos. The woman playing Trina was ill, and her first cover went on, and she had been rehearsed a little bit in the role. She also got sick, and the second cover had to go on with the script in her hand. This was on Broadway during previews because they just hadn't gotten to rehearsals yet. So it is incumbent upon you to know the role you're understudying. However, there's a way to do it discreetly and do your work privately, and then there's a way to be all up in the actress's face, which is kind of what Isabel is doing. She's standing in the wings, mouthing along. She's like, do we lose the connection there, or something sort of beep? Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, okay, so I heard like a weird thing. I heard something cut out, and I thought it might be my phone.
No, it's me, I'm here.
So, so Isabel's sort of all up in Arden's face. She's standing in the wings, mouthing the words. She's like doing everything but stalking her on stage three steps behind her. And she's getting in her way, and everybody's noticing. And what that looks like, of course, is she just can't wait for something to happen to Arden so she can jump in and play her part. And, of course, when something does happen to Arden, everyone's like, oh, well, Isabel obviously killed her because she wants to go on in the leading role. So she crosses that line a little bit too far. But my first job understudying, I was understudying two women, and I think I was a little up in their faces, and they were not happy with me. I went on and knocked it out of the park, but I might have been able to do that without being quite so hungry about it, for want of a better word, so obvious about it. You have to be respectful. You have to maintain a little bit of a distance. You have to be aware it's not your part. You can secretly nurse this suspicion that you are much, much better than the person in the role. Probably you're not, or you'd have been cast there in the first place. But, there are all kinds of reasons why people are cast as understudies. And in this case, the entire creative team thinks Isabel is better for the part, but Isabel wasn't Miss New York. So that's why she doesn't get it.
She was missing. Yeah, I know. So. I know it seems to me that a lot of times, even just watching a movie or whatever, the cast members are really concerned with how they look, how they come off to the critics. What are they going to write about them in Variety? What are they going to say? Yeah.
Absolutely.
So basically, yeah, they were worried about what's going to happen at the first, if the play doesn't open right and the first showing is no good, then why would they have me do the second one, and then the show's going to go nowhere? So that's even scary. To the back of their mind.
There's a lot riding on these things. There's a lot of money behind productions, and if you're an actor, you're out there in the front line and in the front lines, and words can sting.
Yeah, I know, and cast members don't always get along either.
Well, I have to say it's interesting. In my experience, most of the time, casts get along really well. This production of Mamma Mia that I just did, the cast, it was an amazing cast of people. We all got really, really close. When I was in Cyrano on Broadway, that was tremendous. And I went in as a replacement. I replaced somebody. And I was immediately just brought right in with open arms. And for a lot of people, it was their Broadway debut. So it was a very exciting show to be a part of because it was so new for all of us. Nobody had a chance to get jaded or tired. And it was, people stayed in touch. People went to each other's baby showers. And most of the time, companies get along pretty well, but not always. And, there are certainly, it doesn't take more than one rotten apple to make an experience unpleasant for everyone.
That's very true. So when you're doing a murder mystery, how do you decide on the murder weapon? And what kind of examples can you give us that would teach us, for those of us that are writing? I write my horror, from the point of view of the dead person behind the gravestone and what they did.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, it's really weird, but it's great. It's fun.
That is great.
I'm writing the fifth one. I haven't decided who I'm killing off yet, but you never know. So
how
do you determine the murder
weapon? Do you ever get revenge on people in real life by killing them in your books?
Without a doubt.
Yeah, me too.
Without a doubt.
It's one of the perks, right?
Yeah.
It's one of the perks of writing
fun.
Murder mysteries.
Of course,
well,
I write
in fact,
it so
the dead secretary
knows.
In the first book got me fired from my first job for talking on the phone too much.
Yeah, well, what could you do?
Yes, so I got rid of her. I was talking on the phone too much. But
No, I got rid of a lot of people that did a lot worse than that. What can I tell you? So what happens? How do you determine how you're going to kill them?
You know what they say, you know, steal from the best. I've stolen a few from Agatha. I'm not going to give away which poisons in particular I have borrowed. Where did I come up with the secretary in the first book gets stabbed through the heart with a pair of scissors while sitting on the toilet? I thought that was particularly ignominious. And I don't know where I came up with that. Mm-hmm. I can't remember what made me think of the scissors. Second book involves quite a bit of poison. The third book is a gunshot. Well, the gunshot, you know, that came from the fact that, as I mentioned earlier in the third book, And Justice for Some, Isabel and Delphi are doing doing murder mystery dinner theater. And in fact, my friend Kate, who is the inspiration for Delphi, she did a ton of those murder mysteries, and she still does them. And their main murder weapon in those murder mysteries are, you know, prop guns. And of course, if a prop gun, you know, if somebody puts a real bullet in a prop gun, you've got a murder. So that one came kind of hand in hand with the plot.
So what happens next over a period of a few hours? There's the murder, and then the cast members are questioned, and some are brought to the station, and they're not too happy about that. And we meet, she's really a trip, Detective Dillon, and Isabel sort of, she lets him know she's going to take over.
That's Isabel. She's basically like, I wish I'd been like that. I wish I had her moxie. I like to think that if I were in a situation like that, that's who I would be. But no, I would in real life probably be cowering under my desk. She's now solved. By the time we get to Off to Stage Left, she's now solved three murder mysteries. So she's feeling pretty. She's feeling pretty confident. And of course, in each one, and this is sort of a trope in amateur sleuth novels, you know, she takes on the professionals, and the professionals botch it, and the amateur sleuth wins. So it's just another situation like that. And he, of course, is like, "Who the heck are you?" And she's like, "Well, you know, I have a great track record here. I don't know who you are, Mr. Police Detective." So yeah, she basically makes it clear that, and she does it, of course, by unloading all the things that she's already discovered that he has no idea. She's like, "Oh, and by the way, you're looking in the wrong place. You should be looking here, 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 and this is why." And he's like, "Ah, all right." But that's just Isabel. She's a motor mouse. She's a little bit of a know-it-all. But I hope she's likable. I think she's likable. I don't think I'd have as many readers if she were a total bitch. But she's not a bitch. She's not. I mean, she's a nice person. She's over-enthusiastic, if anything, which I was.
Well, she's lucky that the cast members didn't want to.
Yeah, really. Really.
Yeah, no, she gets overpowering after a while, but she's interesting.
But in a good way. I like to think she's a strong personality.
Yeah. So when you created the murder scenes, how do you create a murder scene to make it believable in your novel? I mean, the fact that the person died on stage, that was really good. That was a really good first scene.
I'll be perfectly honest. I'm not sure how truly believable any of my murder scenes are. My husband reads all my books before, you know, in the early stages, and he's like, "Well, that would never happen in real life." I'm like, "I know it would never happen in real life." Suspension of disbelief. I think in certain kinds of mystery novels, you have to really make sure, in thrillers, in procedurals, it really has to seem real. I think readers are drawn to cozy mysteries because there's a sense of safety. There is a sense that that's a clever way to kill someone. That would never happen in real life. So I don't worry so much about them being credible. I'd rather they be interesting. Like you just said, you know, that was pretty great. She, you know, kills over in front of a full audience. So I'd rather they be sort of entertaining and serve the plot. I'm not so concerned. If somebody's going to say, oh, well, that would never happen, and throw the book and close the book and throw it across the room, they've probably already done that before we even get to the murder. this is definitely escapist fiction. It's definitely somewhat fantastical. I like to think of it a little bit as Nancy Drew for grown-ups. And if you go back and read those Nancy Drew books, which my daughter was younger, I revisited some of them, and they're ridiculous. The plots are just completely ridiculous. But
read
it didn't ever stop anybody from loving them.
I loved Nancy Drew when I was a kid, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And
Nancy Drew was my gateway drug.
Linda Pershing just came out with in her own in The Lion's Den, which is like she's created her own sort of Nancy Drew character. The character in her book, it's really good. You have to read it. It's a YA book. It's fantastic.
But she's fabulous, too.
Yeah. So how does Isabel become, you might say, the lead detective on the case? What happens when she becomes Jenny and has to play opposite, of all people, Chris? He's an interesting character.
He's sort of a dark horse. I didn't even mention him. Chris Marshall is the actor who's playing Sousa. I don't want to get too much into some of the plot stuff. Because he's more interesting by way of plot than he is by way of personality. So Jenny Sousa is the leading role. She's Sousa's wife, and that's the part that Arden has been playing. And the part that Isabel is actually playing in the show is Sousa's first girlfriend, who was a young Philadelphia gentlewoman named Emma Swallow. Mm-hmm. And her stepfather intervened and wouldn't let her marry Sousa because he was a musician, God forbid. So Isabel steps in and she's playing opposite Chris, and you know, Chris was the one person on stage with Arden. I will say this is the one person on stage with Arden when she died. So Chris, just by nature of his proximity to Arden during her death, is suspect. Because Isabel is now playing Jenny, someone has to play her part. And fortunately her best friend Delphi has come to visit. And Delphi, who isn't really a great singer, but there's no one else, so she gets plugged in. So it was a way for me to have Isabel there with both Sunil and Delphi.
Well, before I forget, I have put my glasses back on. Before I forget, I want to announce, I'm very excited, next Thursday, the one and only award-winning international author John Land will be here for Strong Cold Dead, and his Caitlin Strong series is fantastic. And this book is John Land at his best. On January 3rd, I am honored to be interviewing the author, Robert Weidman, of An Unexpected Prisoner. He's a prisoner of war from the Vietnam War, and he's going to interview with me exclusively. I'm excited. On January 10th, the author of The Neely Girl. On the 16th, I'm doing a panel show with four fantastic authors, and we're going to talk about narration and narrative voice. But this is the most, this is so exciting. On January 19th, New York Times author Heather Graham and John Land are going to be interviewing with me on their new book that they wrote together, The Rising. And on February 2nd, one of my favorite people, Nightbird, Brian Freeman. I am like so excited. And I just booked a show in April, on April 24th, with Steve Berry, for his new book that's not out yet, The Lost Order. And that's just some of what I'm into. And this is fun, let me tell you.
Mm-hmm.
It's great. And for those people out there that need book reviews, I want you to understand that there is no cost for a book review. I don't get paid to do them. And I don't get paid to do the radio show. I just do it because it's fun and I like to help authors. And I had to make that really clear because there was some word said that Frank gets paid and doesn't get paid for anything. And that's okay. So Delphi is Isabel's best friend.
Mm-hmm.
And she's coming to see the show. And now she's going to be in the show. But can she really sing?
No. And in fact, my friend Kate, who I mentioned, is the model for Delphi. And she knows she is. And she actually sent me an email after she read the book. She's like, my singing isn't that bad, is it? And I'm like, no, of course it's not. I had to exaggerate it for the for the story. So, Delphi is somebody who has always sang well enough when she was in high school and in college to get sort of quirky singing character parts. And she comes to New York, to pursue musical theater and realizes that she isn't really competitive. She's a wonderful actress, though. And in fact, she discovers Shakespeare And this sort of happened. Kate, my friend Kate, decided she didn't want to do musicals anymore. It's not that you can't sing. She just really didn't enjoy them as much. But she's a phenomenal actress, and she's a really gifted Shakespearean actress and Shakespearean director. She actually directed me playing Juliet in Romeo and Juliet, and Marni Nixon was the nurse in that production, which was a dear. And she passed away recently, which was extremely sad. And she was just a dear lady. But Kate is a very gifted Shakespearean actress. So Delphi, like Kate, I'm telling you, I just absolutely pillage from my own life for my books. It's like, be careful what you say to me. It'll wind up in a book. Delphi is not a great singer, and I've sort of exaggerated that, but at this point they need someone immediately, and the cast is so bare bones as it is that there isn't anyone else that they can pluck from the ensemble. It's like they hadn't thought that through, that if Isabel had to go on, they didn't really have anybody to go on in her original part. So Delphi happens to be there, and she winds up taking part in the production, which was a fun way to have her involved.
Well, she was involved, all right.
Uh-huh.
What is next for Isabel? What do you have planned for her next? And
well,
are you going to bring back the same cast members?
Some of them, yes. Some of them, no. The characters who are specific to this particular plot won't come back. But the recurring characters will recur, and James, her temp agent, will be back, and Percival, her brother, will be back. I'm reserving comment on Hugh. I actually haven't decided. Delphi and Sunil will be back, and Isabel will be back in New York. And
okay.
the next book is called. There's only one page of it at this point, but it's going to be called Unreal Estate. And basically, Isabel's temp job will be working as a real estate agent. New Yorkers, as you probably know, are obsessed with real estate, So it's going to be a real estate mystery. And, of course, there will be a theatrical component as well. Haven't entirely decided what that is yet. But, that's what's next.
How did you decide on the cover of the book, and how did you decide on the title?
The cover, actually, I have this wonderful designer. My first book, which is not part of the Isabel Spice series, is a book called Pandora's Bottle, completely different book, more literary fiction. Actually, to give a quick plug about that, it's about a man who spends $500,000 to buy a single bottle of wine that was once owned by Thomas Jefferson, and the waiter serving him drops it. And it's about what happens to the man. Yeah. It's about what happens to the man and the waiter and the girl the man is trying to impress and the woman who owns the restaurant where the event happens. And it actually is based on a real incident, something that happened in 1989 at the Four Seasons restaurant, where $500,000 bottle of Chateau Margaux that allegedly had been owned by Thomas Jefferson went crashing to the floor. And it was a wine appreciation dinner, so there were all these enophiles in the room, and they threw themselves to the floor and started licking the spilled wine off the carpet. And I thought that was hilarious and needed to be made fun of in a book. So I came up with Pandora's Bottle. And the publishers of that book, I loved the cover of Pandora's Bottle. And so when I started writing the first Isabel book, I went back to the cover designer, Linda Pirro, and said, can you do me a cover that has elements that can repeat throughout the series? So all of my books have some of the title is in yellow cursive, and some of it is in block letter white, and they're all like monochrome color on color, and they all have a little icon of Isabel sitting at a laptop. So this one, we knew all along we wanted, dead body on the stage. I definitely, because it's a period piece, because it's, set at the turn of the century, I wanted lace-up boots. And in fact, we found the image, which of course we purchased, but we found the image by searching like Wicked Witch of the West shoes. So that's actually what those are.
Oh, nice.
Isn't that
funny? Nice.
Yeah.
Well,
and the title, The title was tricky.
The title. How did you come up with the title? Yeah, it's interesting. Off Stage Left. That was pretty good.
Off Stage. It's a pun. Off Stage Left. Well, what happened was I started looking. I realized like every really good theatrical murder pun had been taken. You know, death center stage, death in the spotlight, curtain, exit music, you know, curtain call. Like they'd all been taken. And I knew there was a pun out there, and I couldn't find it. And once again, I turned to Facebook, and I was like, guys, help me out here. I had some really good ones. Somebody suggested Proscenium March, which is a play on Proscenium Arch, which, of course, is the front of a theater, front of a stage, but March because John Philip Sousa's marches. I thought that was maybe a little too clever. But my friend Peter came up with Off Stage Left, and it took me a while to go with it because it's a little bit hard to say. It works better when you're looking at it. You get the pun better. And actually, it took us a while, took Linda and me a while, to figure out how we wanted to, just orthographically, how we wanted to spell oft. Was it going to be O-F-F apostrophe D, O-F-F-E-D, and we finally settled on, you know, all caps for off, and then, like, because it's a pun on off stage left, but you're off, you've been killed in the wings, so the E-D is in smaller letters. But so that was a little bit tricky to come up with. Titles are funny. I find either I come up with the title before I write the book, like I have now with Unreal Estate, Temporary Detective I came up with, Bad Publicity I came up with, Injustice for Some I came up with, or I'm really stuck and it's not until the book is written and it really takes a good solid think. That's what happened with Pandora's Bottle too. That one I did come up with myself. It was funny. I didn't know what to call it. And I knew there was a pun and I couldn't find it. I'm like, I know there's a joke. I'm a comedy horse. I'm like, I know there's a joke in here somewhere. And I sort of went, you know what? I'm going to reread the book. I bet the answer is in there. And sure enough, at one point, the auctioneer of the auction house where my protagonist buys the bottle of wine refers to it as Pandora's bottle. I'm like, oh my God, it was, you know, you had the answer all along. I mean, it was there. It was there. I'd already written it, but I hadn't written it with a title in mind, with it in mind as the title. So I thought titles can be tricky.
Well, that's interesting. It took me, when I posted the review this morning, I said, okay, wait a minute, I'm going to spell this right. Because I didn't realize it was O-F-F and then E-D, and I'm saying, okay, wait a minute, it came out, it took me three times. I said, okay, I got it right this time.
See, it's tricky.
So
definitely tricky.
Yeah, it is.
And thank you for the review. I just saw it. That's fantastic. Thank you. I really appreciate
that.
Yeah. Very, very much.
It takes me a while, but I get it done right, I hope.
Fantastic. Well, I'm very grateful.
The books I would recommend, besides Off Stage Left, for Hanukkah are Vector, Cardiac, which is really scary. How would you feel if you had a pacemaker put in and somebody could control whether you have a heart attack because they want you to become part of their group to do something for them that you don't want to do? And the pacemaker is controlled by some other group and you can't control it yourself. What this man does to get around it is scary. It's very scary. The Devil's Triangle by Catherine Coulter is not out yet, but I have it. Nightbird by Brian Freeman is fantastic. It's scary. And I have that too. And Unexpected Prisoner by Robert Wideman. And those are just some of what's out there that's really good. But there are a ton of books that are really great. And if you don't know what to buy somebody for Christmas, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, or anything, or birthday, a book is the greatest present. So before we end, how do you keep the pace moving and reader interest when you're writing something?
I think it's because I come from theater myself, particularly from musical theater. I have a pretty good ear for dialogue, for the way people speak in real life, for that sense of rhythm. But if you're writing a show, and I write for the theater too. My husband and I write musicals together. We're about to write, I think, our sixth musical, and I've written some plays and stuff. And I've certainly been in like. Oh, hundreds of plays or musicals. So you develop, at least I think I have developed, an innate sense of pacing. You know, when you're on stage and you're in a scene that is slow moving, you feel it. You can feel the audience wilting. So I feel like I'm pretty attuned to that. And some of it is just, if I'm getting bored, it's time to, when I'm in the process of writing, if I'm getting bored with myself, it's probably time to end the scene and move on, or maybe I don't even need that scene in the first place. So it's kind of an instinct that I've developed over my years of performing and writing. And the two really go hand in hand, whether or not you're writing about an actress. I think it's true.
So before we end, tell us, where can we find out more about your work and all of your books and all of your titles?
Thanks. Well, my website is joannesidneylesner.com, and there are links to all of my books and information about my performing, if that is of interest. But most importantly, review links and descriptions of the book and purchase links. You can purchase the paperback. The paperback's on Amazon, and it's also available on Kindle and Nook, Kobo, Smashwords, iTunes. I'm everywhere.
Well, that is interesting. So when do you predict that the next book is going to come out?
Definitely not in 2017 as much as I would like it to, mostly because I have a commission to write a musical that's being produced. We already have production dates in May. So that is absolutely going to be my top priority for the first few months of the year. So I would hope in the spring of 2018, Unreal Estate, the fifth Isabel Spice mystery, will hit the stands.
Well, that's different. So what's this musical about that you commissioned to write about?
Well, this is an interesting project. We're actually writing a musical for London's Royal Central School of Speech and Drama. They have a Master's in Musical Theatre program, and they like to give their students the one-year program. They like to give their students an original musical to work on as their final project. And so we were commissioned to create something for them. And we have the rights to the classic play Stage Door by George S. Kaufman and Edna Ferber. I think I have that backwards. I think Edna gets top credit. Edna Ferber and George S. Kaufman. And we're working on adapting that right now. And it's a fun project, tons of fun. But that's definitely
going to be taking up. Well, as a music major, and I was very good and proficient in violin and piano, I had to create my own sonata. That was tough because I had to be able to play it. Not only did I have to play it, but I had to be able to transpose it into every single key, major and minor.
Oof.
So it required hours of practice. And the only reason I majored in music is because I went into the dean and I said I want to be a language major. And he said, if you're going to work with elementary school kids and you play the piano, you're going to major in music. And little I know at the time I could have said no. But I met the nicest people, the strangest professors, but I know I knew Wagner and Verdi and all of them, because in order to pass the test, they would drop the needle and they would.
Oh, we had dropped. I was a music major also. We had dropped the needle tests.
They had to drop the needle. You had to tell them where they dropped it.
Yep.
There was one recording in my music history class,
and drop the needle. We're talking needles, so we're obviously talking about the same era. But there was one record. Yes, I said record. There was one record that skipped, and you'd put we would listen to it in the music library, and we'd put the needle down, and it would just go beep, beep, beep. It would just skip all across, and we were like, oh, this is great, because he's going to put this on, and we'll know what it is because it's the one that skips. It's, I forget what it was. It was like Symphony of Psalms or something. So he puts it on, and it goes, and he was a German man. He goes, oh, we cannot use this record because it skips. And we were like, no, that's the only one we know because it's the one that skips.
Yeah, I know. I had to write which part of the sonata and which part of the symphony it was, and then go like, oh my God. And there's certain, like, Wagner was not one of my favorite people. But anyway,
he's a little problematic. Not one of my faves either. But
thank you so much for today.
This is my pleasure.
This has been fun, and Cheryl just emailed me, and she's been listening.
Oh, good. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, Cheryl. Cheryl and the people at Partners in Crime are the best. I did my blog show with them also.
Wonderful.
They're fantastic. They take good care of the authors, and they make sure that your book gets out there, and they make sure that my reviews get out there, and they make sure they send me the books even if I don't ask for them. That's even better. I pretty much do all of them. So, everyone, the good part is the sun's shining and the snow went away. Yay!
Yeah.
Finally. Have a great day, and when the next one comes out, you know who to send it to.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for having me. It was, find me an actor who doesn't like to talk about herself.
Yeah, well, that's okay. You did a great job, and this is a fun interview. So thank you, everyone. Have a great day, and bye.
Thank you. Happy holidays.